Mobile, wireless, digital, wearable, telehealth, gaming and connected health are all tools that are fast becoming part of the health and wellness landscape. These devices and applications are becoming an integral part of every doctor's office, every hospital, every gym and fitness center, and in fact of every home across America and the world. We are now surrounded by technology, but are we using it to its best advantage? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Dr. Nerida, welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Technology is being blamed for turning us into screen junkies and couch potatoes. Instead of manual labour, we can accomplish many tasks at the press of a button. We've moved off the farm and into the cities, out of the barn and into the office, where we sit for hours every day using technology. Or is it using us? Isn't it time for us to get smart, to control technology rather than it controlling us? But is that possible? Here's a report by AFP from this year's Consumer Electronics Show. Let's take a look at what's on the horizon for health and fitness technology.
Who said geeks aren't sporty? At this year's CES Technology Show, health is top of the agenda, and new wearable sensors can measure your every move.
Our sensor is in the bottom of the headphone. We monitor blood flow, and we have movement sensors in the headphone. We can measure heart rate and calories, speed, distance.
The market for connected health products is growing at around 5% a year and is forecast to be worth $6 billion by 2017. It's given rise to a new trend known as the quantified self movement. Devotees try to measure, analyze and upload as much information as possible about their physical well-being with a view to better health. And the measurements don't even stop when you're asleep. This device tracks your heart rate and movement at night to wake you up at the optimum time.
This part here is the sensor, and this goes under the mattress. It works silently, of course, without disturbing you, and measures your sleep very accurately. It knows when you move. It monitors your breathing patterns and heartbeat.
There are other, more general health applications on display too, such as this pill box, which syncs with a smartphone app, monitoring a patient's medicine intake.
When this part is put in this smart pill box, it becomes connected, and it makes sure the patient takes the right medicine at the right time.
It's not all hard work either. These sensors attach to shoes so children can use them to control video games.
Kids are constantly on computer, on games and on everything, so if we can encourage them to do physical activity while continue to play these video games, I think it's great.
This year's CES shows that connected health technology is gaining ground, but it's likely to be some time before it's a standard part of the doctor's surgery.
However, it doesn't have to be in the doctor's office for us to benefit when we take charge of our own health. On today's show, we have a tasty hot pot in the kitchen and an internationally renowned expert on technology for lifestyle change. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the health and fitness gadgets that you could use to motivate change. But first, the news. In the headlines today, health apps linked to well-being, wearables not worn, and online on track. A new Gallup poll reveals that people are increasingly using mobile health technology to improve their well-being. About half of smartphone users have downloaded at least one healthy living app, and 20% routinely use that app. Apps for calorie counting are the most popular, followed by apps for health recipes and food or exercise diaries. But do they work? Well, it's too early to tell, but in the survey, regular app users had better well-being than non-users. So put your smartphone to work with a healthy living app that works for you. There's a lot of hype surrounding the release of health and fitness wearables. However, a survey by PricewaterhouseCoopers suggests that once the novelty wears off after about a year, one-third of users abandon their devices. However, 70% said they would be willing to wear a device in exchange for lower insurance premiums. There are approximately 150 options on the market with an average price tag of $400. However, if it enhances how you perceive and engage in health and fitness, then it's a small price to pay. An online behavioural intervention has helped people lose an average of 12 pounds in 3 months and maintain that loss for at least 3 months. The research was done on a group of overweight and obese individuals. Half the group was asked to view weekly online newsletters about the benefits of healthy eating, weight loss and exercise, information that you might receive from your doctor. They lost only 1% of their body weight. The intervention group was asked to view a 10 to 15 minute interactive video each week on topics like eating out in restaurants, changing the home environment, and the value of social support. They also used a website to report their daily calorie intake, exercise, and body weight, and received automated feedback based on their progress. They lost almost 8% of their body weight and kept it off, so it seems weight loss intervention needs to be continuous, ongoing, and engaging. Not surprising, really. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. I want to introduce you to Dr. Simon Marshall, Associate Professor of Exercise and Nutritional Science at San Diego State University. He has a bachelor's and master's degree in exercise science and a PhD in exercise psychology. We caught up with him at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting in San Diego. So I asked him if technology is good for us or bad for us, since he's so heavily into it and using it as an intervention in a lifestyle change.
I try to come in as a researcher with sort of a neutral stance. I know that my early research was on the role of TV viewing and video game playing as it leads to childhood obesity. And the media, of course, have blamed television viewing and video games particularly, quite heavily, in fact, for one of the big major causes of childhood obesity. So that got me thinking about the role of technology in young people's lives as a force of ill health, but also can it be used, and if so, how, to promote healthy choices and healthy behaviours. So I moved away from looking at TV and video games to then looking at other activity or technologies that would promote active choices. In young people?
Yes, because young people are high users.
Right.
What sort of percentage are we looking at?
So, well, it's a simple question, but it's quite difficult to answer. And one of the reasons is that when we do these studies, there's two agencies in particular that do research on how young people are using media, including technology. One is the Pew Research Foundation, and the other is the Kaiser Family Foundation. They produce, they're not annual reports, but they're pretty frequent reports on the state of use of these technologies. So the latest data that we have is about 3 to 4 years old now. We do know that things are moving more and more towards phone-based. So smartphones are becoming a hub where everything is becoming located, partly because battery life's improving, they become more effective at hosting applications and games and stuff, and in addition to watching television on a phone. So the age at which young people start owning phones is getting younger and younger as we go, and there have been some studies now with children as young as 9 using cell phones for health behaviour change. And what's quite remarkable is when you talk to young people how technologically literate they are. And in fact, babies now are able to learn to swipe, and which is, you know, the key movements on iPads and iPhones. So they're growing up with these technologies. So it's ultimately how do they use or consume media on these devices, and then how we can develop programs and platforms to deliver strategies to get them to make good choices, active choices.
Babies using screens doesn't sit well with me, but that's the reality. And even for children, it is all about making active choices. So we'll dive right into that topic after the break. But first, this.
What you doing?
Oh, I'm mulching these vegetables. They're organic, you know.
Oh, that's a really good idea, because all the vegetables in the market are full of pesticides, aren't they?
So is that fish you're eating.
What?
Yeah.
No way. We all know that the biggest concern with pesticides is with vegetables and fruits, not with fish.
Oh, really? You've never heard of biomagnification?
Biomagnification? magnificent?
Biomagnification. You know, the big fish eat lots of little fish, but eat tons of phytoplankton plants living in pesticide-contaminated waters. And so as you go up the food chain, the concentration of pesticide gets magnified up to 10,000 times.
Oh, and I'm eating it?
Uh-huh. Happens with most meat.
Oh, no. So this is a chemical warehouse?
That's right.
So I should have ordered that phytoplankton burger instead.
Go vegetarian. Reduce your pesticides, herbicides, toxic chemicals, and your heavy metals. Doctor's orders. We're back. And it's time to cook. We're in the kitchen. Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so excited about this. It already smells good.
Yes.
So I know this is going to be a great recipe.
I've already started cooking. And what we're making today is dal, or red lentils.
Oh, it's such a great... I love Indian food, and that's one dish that I really enjoy.
And it's so simple, so tasty, and it just kind of knits your whole plate together. So tell us what's in it, if you can read them off for us.
Sure. This is half an onion, then two tablespoons of oil, 2 tablespoons of water, a clove of garlic chopped, 1 tablespoon of bruised cumin seeds, 1 pound of red lentils, 1 teaspoon of curry powder, and 1 teaspoon of turmeric, and a handful of cilantro.
Great. So what I've done is I've already started cooking these onions and the garlic. You want to do the onions, fry them until in a little oil and water, because then you can cut down how much oil that you use. So if you put them in together to start with, then they're not going to splatter and spit everywhere.
And then on top of that, to me, the aroma of cooking onions is just amazing.
Yeah.
I love when that kind of permeates the kitchen.
Oh, it's
so good. It's a great start.
Yes. There's garlic in there with it. And everyone here is raving about the smell. So we've got that frying now. This is a little unusual, but I wash the lentils, and I just put them here in a sieve. It's easy, run the water through. They need a good wash, and then just tip them in. And you can see once they get dry, they clump together, turns into concrete. Get those out.
You would think with the meal that you see at the end, you wouldn't think that they'd get so hard.
No, you wouldn't, because it ends up being so soft.
They just don't want to come out.
No, they don't.
Dr. Nerida versus the lentils.
Yep. She won. And we're going to fry these lentils. And what that does is kind of seals the outside. And they somehow hold their shape a little bit better later on once they're boiled. So... get them frying.
Now those are red lentils. There are different types of lentils. Is there a reason to choose red over another?
You know, this is the cook's favorite because it cooks so fast. The other lentils will take a lot longer to cook, or if you want to soak them ahead of time, you can cook them quicker. But these, you come home from work and you go, oh, what am I going to cook? Need a protein. Throw your red lentils in and 15, 20 minutes, they're done.
Especially with coming home late, being tired, all that's a perfect thing to do just because you want to have something fast. You're hungry, especially the kids. You know, it's a great, easy thing to do.
Yes, it is. And different lentils are going to have different amino acid makeup of their protein. So it's good to switch it up. But this is just the real quick and probably one of the most popular flavors of all the lentils. There are dozens and dozens of different lentils that you can get. So once that's fried up, we want to add our curry powder and turmeric. I've just mixed them together, pop them in, and fry that for another minute or so.
Now while you're doing that, you need these bruised.
Oh, right? Yes. Oh, yes. Bruise the cumin seeds. I'm sorry, I forgot to put them in when we'd just done the lentils. We would normally put the cumin seeds in right after the onions and the garlic have...
Now, I'm not crushing this. I'm not turning them into powder. I'm just bruising them.
That's right.
Which is just a little bit Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Oh, that smells amazing.
Doesn't it? That's what bruising does. It just put them on the bottom. Bruising just brings out the oil and just releases the flavour. So that's it. So once that's fried for a little bit, we're going to add our boiling water. I cheat. I just boil this in the kettle first so that it comes to the boil fast. And we're going to want to add quite a bit, because those lentils absorb quite a bit of water. I usually keep an eye on them while they're simmering, and they'll simmer now for about 20 minutes. Just keep the lid on, and they're good to go.
And so from that, red lentils become this.
Yes, they do. Add a little bit of turmeric, it brings the yellow colour out, but they turn yellow anyway while they're being cooked.
Well, this looks amazing. I can smell it, so I can't wait to try this. Mmm. That's one thing I love. It's just a bunch of different spices. It's terrific. And with our rice, this is an amazing meal that I'm going to look forward to after this.
And this is a whole grain plus a legume, complete protein.
Perfect.
So great meal and easy to do. Remember, all our recipes are on our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. Now here's a minute hack on how to turn fitness into a game by using the technology you already own, your phone.
Tired of feeling inadequate compared to your ripped and toned trainer at the gym? Not self-motivated enough to stay on the treadmill longer than 3.5 minutes? For extra motivation, turn your workouts into a game with these new apps. A Kickstarter-funded success, Zombies Run is a fitness game which puts you into a zombie video game, sending you on 20 to 30-minute missions requiring you to run, and run fast because zombies are after you. The app offers 30 different missions, allows you to run with music, work out in the gym or outside, and even opt for interval training. Fleetly, designed by a former triathlete, tracks your workouts as you improve, and similar to Foursquare, awards you recognition when you succeed at a challenge. You can also compete against others. More of a travel bug? Turn your workouts into a whirlwind travel adventure with Teemo, the app that virtually drops you into the world's toughest fitness environments and gets your heart rate pumping and calories burning. Similar to Fleetly, Fitocracy is all about community competition, but even more similar to a video game which sends you on a mission, assigning you a task each day to get fit. But don't worry, you'll be rewarded, virtually speaking, of course.
And virtually speaking is where it's at for many kids. By nature, they're very competitive, so it's easy to build health into games, isn't it?
So I think that's a bit, in fact, that's a topic that many people are interested in, the gamification of health for children. And it really just simply means that how we can apply principles of game theory. So if you think about a traditional video game where there's leveling, you earn points and you level up and get increasing more competence or skill, and that enables you to do more and more things. So they're taking these concepts which we know are very rewarding, behaviorally rewarding to children, and not just children but adults as well, and embedding them in routine activities to get them to be more active. And so earning points and badges and so on for getting a certain amount of activity based on pedometers or accelerometers. And studies show that kids respond to that. We don't have enough data on whether it lasts, so the long-term compliance to these sorts of strategies work. The shelf life of most games is so short now because we have this it's called app grazing. We have a tendency to pick up particular apps or games, try them for a short period, and if it doesn't immediately grab our attention, drop them and not use them again, because there's so much competition for our attention for options to do this. And so
How long most people would pick up an app and use it?
Right. We don't know how long they'd pick up. Children would. Most adults, if it doesn't capture their attention in 2 to 3 minutes, they're not likely to use it more frequently or many times again, unless they've either been asked to, recommended to, or it serves some other function. It's not just this looks good, I'll download that and give it a go. Children, of course, have a much shorter attention span.
So we're looking at 2 minutes for adults, but children are even shorter.
Oh, children are much shorter, right. And so we don't have any organic studies, which means that we look at children in the wild and see how they play and how long it takes them to get bored or fatigued with a certain app. We do have some of those studies in adults, but we don't in children. Most of the studies in children, we've asked them to try using this. They're enrolled in a study and they have to keep with it. But even with active games, active video games, one good example is the sort of Dance Dance Revolution. You might have seen some of those. We know, for example, that after about 4 weeks, there's a precipitous drop-off in their use of them. And we've done randomized control trials ourselves, good, well-designed experimental studies where we've given children different types of video games and monitored remotely and objectively how long they play them for across a 12-week period. And you find that it drops off tremendously within the first 2 or 3 weeks. And most children, the majority of children, by week 6 to 8 are not using them at all. Mm-hmm. So it's hard.
Now, you mentioned that gamification can also be used for adults.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
So again, it's a principle, again, it lends itself from game theory, the fact that for what's a rewarding practice for behavior is to focus on competition is one element, social comparison is another, and reward. We're motivated by reward. So what's happened most of the time has been in related to pedometer use. So there's many different programs that are out there that, based on the number of steps that there's a kind of league table, and you can earn points or sometimes prizes or incentives by employers or by companies to actually do more. Adults, of course, are much more. What to use here? Are much more sort of. They soon figure out that one, if there's an incentive that they can game the system to make it work for them, that starts to supersede the message of the game in the first place. Particularly if there's a financial incentive or a product-based incentive. So some companies, for example, have rewarded with like Amazon vouchers for books and other things, and they soon know that they're going to do everything they can to maximize the reward without doing the behavior. So it's a double-edged sword for those sorts of programs.
So what should you look for in an app? What does research show us is a valuable thing to look for in an app or in a device?
In a game. Well, I think the first thing to distinguish between a device and an app. And so apps, of course, are simply a way of delivering information or delivering some functionality. In themselves, they're not actually anything in particular. So it's really what I urge people to do is to look into what a particular app or wireless device is claiming to do. And we have some really good evidence in behavioral science, that's the science of how you get people to change their behavior, of what works, what's the most potent strategies that we'd like to see embedded in some of these devices. And the most potent is a device that encourages you to self-monitor, to track what you're doing. And in fact, studies have shown that even if you don't ask people to act on that information, just providing people with a chance to measure and record what they're doing leads to change. We know that from pedometers. So a device or an app, or any tool that encourages you to record what you're doing as easy as possible. Self-monitoring has been used in psychological literature for many years, but the challenge is that it's really dull to keep a journal, and it's hard and it's boring, and most people don't do it. So technology can take away some of the boredom and the pain of doing self-monitoring in a passive, easy-to-record way. So pedometers or Fitbits or these other wireless devices are good ways of doing that. And apps that are on your cell phone, because your cell phone already has GPS capabilities and other sensors, it can wirelessly collect the information, but then also decode it and give you feedback about what you've been doing without you having to have any intervention at all. So self-monitoring is really important.
So you can take your phone for a run. Some of our viewers may not be aware of this.
Right.
You take your phone for a run and it knows exactly where you run or a walk, and it will then you download that information at the end.
Exactly. There are some free apps like Map My Run and Run Mondo and a few of the others, they rely on the GPS, the satellite signal between your phone and the satellite or a cell phone tower to record where you're moving to. And combined with the accelerometer in the phone can tell you the intensity with which you're moving and give you simple metrics after it. You've just walked or run 4 miles at this speed, at this elevation gain, and so on. So you can track yourself like that pretty easily now for free if you have a smartphone.
If you think we're speaking a foreign language, I want to show you just a few of the gizmos that are out there to self-monitor right after the break. But before that, consider this. Generally speaking, we're curious creatures. We like to know how far we walked, how long it took, and how many calories we burned. And now with technology, it's easy to collect that data. Technology allows us to be more aware and in control of our day-to-day lives. We can leave digital footprints that account for most of our day on computers, smartphones, or wearable devices. When Jesus was on earth, sometimes people urged him to do something at a certain time.
And occasionally he would respond, "My time has not yet come." What was he saying? That God had a timetable and he didn't want to run ahead of it. He wanted to remain aligned with his Father's will. And if we're in tune with God, we can do the same. Our day can go according to his will. If your day becomes a little disconnected, consider the possibility that God may be interrupting your schedule. Someone once said that our disappointments may be divine appointments. So next time it happens, be open to what might be around the corner. And as you clip on your pedometer each day, remember not to race blindly through your day. Instead, give God permission to arrange divine appointments along the way. Welcome back, and it's time to get out of that chair and join us. Sean, what have you got?
All right, we got some fun today, all right? Today we're going to go a little bit slower, okay? And what I want you to concentrate on is taking your time, okay? We're going to use some dumbbells here. You can use any kind of dumbbells you want. We'll try and find something that's challenging. These say 5s on it, but in my mind, they're like 50s.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
So you can spot me if you want.
They're okay? 5 kilos.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. All right, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. All right? So let's warm. What we're going to do is buckets, okay?
Oh, okay.
I love them because it's just a good way to get the body warmed up, all right?
Yeah, and they're going to give your quads a good stretch.
They do. Bring your heart rate up a little bit, prepare you for moving. Even though we're moving a little bit slower today, this is still a good one just to get you to get your body used to exercise. 3, 2, and 1. All right, so we're going to grab these weights. My 50 pounders.
Yep.
Okay. Lean forward. All right. You have your weight here. And what I want you to do is kick, almost, it's called a kickback, all right? Because you're pushing back, all right? So 3, 2, 1, go. 1. We're going to 5, 4, 3, 2, and hold it right there. All right. It's almost like a skiing position where we're working those triceps, body is tight, abdominal area is pushed in, and you're working that tricep, okay? Give me 2 more. 1 and 2. What I want you to do is at the end of each exercise, you need to slow down and contract, right? Those triceps, all right?
Yeah, makes a big difference. It doesn't surely look very different, but it sure feels
it surely different. Does. And what we're gonna do next is called a chest press, okay? Literally laying here, okay? And putting the weight right here. Okay, your feet are gonna stay here. And the goal here is to do that rotation. Now what we did before was the kickback, okay?
Right.
And what I want you to do is do a rotation here, okay? And back down. Rotate.
Well, you're doing well with 50 pounds, Rachel.
Oh, hold on. So remember, your palms are facing your feet as you start, and they should be facing behind you when you're done, so that you can continue to work those triceps that we just worked at the same time working your delts. If you wanted to make this exercise a little bit more difficult, you can put your feet out here, okay? If you're experiencing any back pain?
No, I'm not. You could be.
All you can do, relax, is bring your feet up just a little bit more.
Right.
In preparation for our third exercise, which is gonna be a toe touch, okay?
All right. Well, I like being the trainer. I think I'll be the trainer next time.
You're a wonderful trainer. You don't
come on, bring it a little further.
You don't yell at me.
Toe touch. They're nowhere near those toes.
What I want you to do is reach for those toes, all right? It
right.
is working
you're
your dumb.
All the way up the ground, you're simply.
There it is, okay? So you can prepare yourself for that second exercise, the chest press, okay, by picking those legs up just a little bit, just so that you can work that abdominal area, and then you go right into your toe touch. Everything is kind of connected so that when you're doing a workout, there's no thinking involved. You can just go from one to the next to the next.
Yeah.
Okay?
Excellent.
So there you go. 3 exercises.
Great.
Using your dumbbells, working a little bit of the triceps.
What are we stretching?
Oh, right. What are we going to stretch since we work those delts? Let's go here.
All right.
Relax that shoulder. I think I worked up a sweat.
You did.
I think I did.
I worked it up, but
I hope you did too.
Oh, yeah.
And stretch.
The those 50 pounds.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Oh, I'm so sore. That's my story. Sticking to it. Yep. All right, relax, open and close. Okay. Another great exercise I like is just taking your hands, locking them here, and just bringing up as high as you can.
Nice stretch there.
Yeah. Opens up your chest, stretches out your triceps, and you kind of feel your tension kind of ease away. All right. Mm. And relax. Shake it out again. All right, I hope you're sweating with us.
Oh, I'm sure you are. Thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
What could you do with an extra 5 years? Earn a degree, visit the 7 modern wonders of the world, or kiss your great-grandchild's cheek? You can do a lot in 5 years. 5 years is the difference that researchers found in the life expectancy between vegetarian and non-vegetarian Adventists. The Adventist Health Study found that vegetarians lived 5 years longer than their non-vegetarian counterparts. Adopting a vegetarian diet could add 5 years to your life and is another ageless advantage.
And now for your questions. Someone called and asked, what causes calcium to build up and produce chest pain? I've been through many heart tests and nothing has been found. Well, calcium buildup is actually a consequence of atherosclerosis of the arteries, and that blocks the small arteries supplying the heart muscle. When there's not sufficient blood coming through, there's insufficient oxygen reaching those tissues, and then chest pain is experienced, which we call angina. If there's no calcium buildup, it can still be spasm of those arteries. Either way, it's serious, but it can be reversed by having a low-fat, vegan diet. Daniel posted on Facebook, do you know a treatment for obstructive sleep apnea that doesn't involve CPAP, surgery, and weight loss, since I don't need to lose weight? Well, the mandibular advancement splint is kind of the big name for it. But it's definitely worth checking out. It's a device that looks a little bit like a mouth guard, but it's for the top and the bottom teeth, and the lower jaw gets locked forward from where it normally would rest. If it's locked forward, it prevents the tongue from falling back while you're sleeping, obstructing the airway. We have 2 archived shows on our website. One's called Johnny's Journey, one is Sleep Apnea, and that will give you a lot of information about these devices. Someone else called and asked, as we age, why does our memory fail? Well, unfortunately, cognitive decline happens from the age of 30. We lose neuronal connections quite a bit from that age onwards. And then also as we get even older, we actually lose those nerve cells or those neurons. And if we get atherosclerosis of the blood vessels supplying the brain, we get less blood flow to the brain as well. So multiple factors can do it. However, you can slow down brain aging by doing 3 things. Being physically active, especially in earlier life. So it's never too early to start. By eating a whole food, plant-based diet that's full of antioxidants, because that reduces the aging speed of your cells, each and every cell. And 3, the old adage, use it or lose it. So teach your brain new tricks, force it to work faster, and keep it working. Thanks for those questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text, or Facebook those questions into me. Keep them coming. I love them. Now it's time to go shopping. Oranges are, well, orange, inside and out. They can come with thick skin, thin skin. They can be bitter oranges or sweet. Oranges originated somewhere in Asia, between southern China and Indonesia. Then they spread to India and on to the rest of the world. Now Brazil and Florida are the main growers of oranges. Oranges are a great source of potassium, magnesium, folate, of course vitamin C, and fiber. One medium orange contains 65 calories. So you can't eat too many at once. So they're a great way to go low on calories. Orange zest is a secret ingredient you can put in many recipes, but only get the orange part. Don't go below because the pith or the white part becomes bitter. You know, there's nothing like freshly squeezed orange juice to wake your taste buds up in the morning. Bon appetit. Today's guest is Simon Marshall, Senior Research Scientist in the Center for Behavioral and Community Health Studies in the School of Public Health at San Diego State University. He's involved in a CDC-funded project involving the use of pedometers to increase physical activity among Latino adults. I asked him whether pedometers really do motivate people to increase their physical activity.
Pedometers are really sort of a simple technology. They've been around for many years now. The insides of a pedometer has changed over the last 5 to 10 years. They've moved away from sort of a mechanical lever arm that opens and closes a circuit now to more sophisticated devices that measure acceleration so that you can measure intensity of movement. But a pedometer is still a device that counts steps, which is a measure of how many times that you put one foot in front of the other a day. And we have some good evidence that a certain number of steps is beneficial to your health. And so pedometers are a great way to motivate behavior change.
Now, do they work for any age group? Are they best with certain age groups?
They work with all age groups. Because the most accurate way to wear them is around your waist, because if the closer the pedometer is to your center of gravity, your center of mass, the more closely it relates to the intensity of movement as opposed to something on your wrist. Mm. So people who do have a lot of sort of trunk fat or adiposity around their middle, if the pedometer hangs over at a slightly strange angle, it can make them slightly distort the reading, so they can be less accurate. But with all pedometers, the best way to know whether you've got a good one or a bad one, either just it's a manufacturing default or the way that your body is, it doesn't count accurately, is to put it on and manually count 100 steps or manually count 20 steps and open your pedometer and see whether it records the same thing. And usually if you're within one or two steps, it's fine.
And if it's not?
If it's not, you can take it back to get a new one. The challenge is that the pedometers that are made in Japan, like Omron is a one company, Japan is the only country that has industry standards for pedometer accuracy. So if you buy a pedometer from any other country, the US included, then if it's not accurate, there's really nothing you can do about it. The company is not mandated to make them accurate. So if you can buy one from a company that either publishes how accurate they are or stands by their accuracy data, or it's from Japan, then you're better off buying one of those.
Now, how effective are they? So you buy a good quality pedometer, work out that it's functioning properly.
Right.
And then
how do you use it
and how much will it change you?
Right. Well, they've studied that too. So if you simply give someone a pedometer and tell them nothing else, just here's a pedometer, assuming that they've heard of a pedometer, and most people have even heard of I'm supposed to be doing so many steps, you get an immediate 40% bump in activity. Of course, the downside is that lasts for a week. Okay. So when you're starting off with any program, it's a good idea to think that you're going to be probably highly or unusually motivated in that first week. It's a new toy, it's a new device. The real challenge is, are you able to do that after the first week, the second week, and the third week, and so on?
So the more you spend on it, the more likely you are to keep
using it,
because you've invested at least some money.
And we know, though, that setting a goal is critical. If you want to improve the ability of your problem to change your behavior, is find a goal that you can work to every day for your steps, and that helps.
Is it good to just wear it, not do anything differently, just ignore it, don't even look at it, and find out what you've done over, say, 2-3 day period?
Yeah.
I mean, if you find out where you're at, what's the best
way
to do that?
Sure, that's the scientist in you, to gather some baseline data for you. Absolutely.
Because otherwise, if you keep looking at it all day, you tend to just walk so far that you've tired by the end of your first day. It puts you off wanting to continue to use it.
So what we often recommend is that you can't tell people you can, but it doesn't work, to not look at it, because they do. They want to sneak a peek to see how you're doing. But what we really tell people to do is we start having them set goals and work on sort of almost like the software, as the human side of using one, after day 3 or 4. So the initial familiarization is sort of you wear it, you're getting used to it, you're seeing how it works. But really the behavior change stuff, the lasting behavior change stuff really starts on sort of day 3 or day 4, because then the novelty of it is usually worn off and they're less likely to be motivated by opening up every 10 minutes to see how they're doing.
Right. And then how much change do you encourage them, like if they're setting goals, how much change and how often?
Right. So it depends on where they're at to begin with. So that's why it's a good idea to do some sort of self-monitoring of how much you walk within a typical day without changing anything. So we're interested in daily routines or habits. So again, if we would start that on day 3 or day 4, so now I want you to not try and change your routine at all, knowing that it will be slightly higher just because it's hard for people to do that. And to do that for 2 or 3 days, to see what a typical day is like for them. Some people we recommend do it for a week, because they have no one day is the same. and then take an average of daily steps in a week. And then we ask them to try and change it by 10%. So sometimes it's difficult because obviously people are having to do some math and it's not that comfortable to do. But we know that most people are likely to do around 5,000 to 6,000 steps a day if they're not particularly active. So they don't have a particularly active job, they're not an athlete, they may not have, and they don't have sort of a chronic disease that impairs their ability to walk. There's a good chance that they'll be in that range. And so asking people to do another 1,000, 1,500 steps to try and get up to 7,000 or 8,000 is a really good goal for that first month.
And what's the evidence? If someone's committed to using it, typically they'll just keep using it. Does it just teach them to be more active and after a while they can set it aside?
Yeah.
Or what's long-term use like?
So I'll start from the other end, the short-term use. Across 2 weeks, we still find about 90 to 100% of people are still using them. So 2 weeks is not really a good measure. After about a month, we're now down to about 60%, 60 to 70%. And after 12 weeks, we're now down to 20 and 30%. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that people no longer they just put it in the drawer and they no longer can be bothered with it. Sometimes if you've worn a pedometer for enough time, you know what a 5,000 step day feels like. You know what an 8,000 day step feels like. So we're not trying to make people become reliant on technology. We're saying learn habits, learn what those habits feel like, and then you can start to actually use or get steps without actually recording it. But it's always good to every now and again, maybe every 3 months or 6 months, just to have a little booster or wear it again to see how you're doing.
Today we're talking about mobile health technology and how you can use it effectively to improve your health. After the break, Simon and I will discuss a phone app that really changed his life, and we'll discuss how technology can impact up to one third of every day. So stay with us. And we're back. Now I want you to meet former Olympic runner Missy Kane. Watch this.
There's three things I don't leave home without: my cell phone, my car keys, and my handy dandy pedometer. I really find that pedometer will keep me in line as far as getting in more steps every day, and I like to try to get in 10,000 steps a day. However, I just read a report from Harvard that noticed that people that even got in 6,000 steps a day who were inactive before really improved their cardiovascular readings, their weight loss, and the way they felt. So here's just a little rule of thumb. If you get a pedometer, and a lot of people would suggest a lot of Japanese brands are the best. I happen to use Omron. But get a pedometer that you know is going to last, and put it on right about your hip levels where I use mine, and wear that every single day. Then if you notice the first day that on an easy day you only get 3,000 or 4,000 steps in, half that. So if you get 4,000 in, half that and add that as your goal. So for you guys being inactive, 6,000 steps a day might be your goal. Then if you get in 8,000 steps, but you think, I really need to get fitter, I need to lose some weight, well, take that half of that, which would be 4,000, and shoot to get 10 to 12,000 steps a day. The great thing about a pedometer is, if I have a day where I come home and I think, you know, I'm tired, I've done a lot, I'll look down and I only have 6,000 steps in. Well, then I'm apt to go walk my dogs or play basketball with my 10-year-old who loves for me to do that with her, because every step counts when it comes to getting fit.
So let's make every step count. Our guest today is Simon Marshall. We didn't get to meet his wife, Leslie Patterson, but she is the 3-time off-road triathlon world champion. And by the way, he walks the talk too. I asked him if he has personally used any mobile health technology to change his behavior.
I'm an active person. I've been a competitive cyclist for many years, and when work takes over, you become less active. And then I had a back problem. I had a pinched nerve in my lower spine, and my wife had recommended I start swimming. And I hate swimming. I swam as a kid. I loved the water, but I knew she's a triathlete. I knew the kind of swimming that she meant, which is lap upon lap of mind-numbingly dull, boring swimming. And I just didn't really want to do it. So what I thought I'd do is I'll create an experiment for myself, and I'm going to self-monitor my own mood and my back pain in response to swimming. So I found an app, a free app called Mood Panda. It's literally exactly that, the picture of a panda bear on it. It's free. And it's an app where you, a little sliding scale, rate your happiness or mood however many times a day you want to do it, and then you can make some notes about it, about what was going on when you rated it. So I started using Mood Panda before, the day before I swam, the day leading up to when I swam, about back pain and mood, and then right immediately after I'd swum, and then for the rest of the day. And I was convinced, even after a week or 2 weeks, and I was doing it this for a month, that swimming, I still didn't particularly enjoy it as much. It was hard and it was painful, inconvenient.
Yes.
And then I looked at my data, and lo and behold, I found that my mood improved after swimming. My back pain was less after swimming. And this cannot be true. I don't like swimming, and I still don't like swimming. So it took a little self-monitoring experiment for me to say, you know what, this works. And so I started to think, well, even if I don't enjoy the act of swimming and getting changed and going to the pool, I know that my back feels better and I have evidence that I feel better emotionally. So I'm going to continue doing it. And then I actually started to like swimming.
So it became like a swim instructor for
you. It did.
You.
It became, and it started to become a habit, and I still swim.
Is that right?
I do.
Wow.
I went this morning.
Well, good for you. Now, another habit that we have that we're actually very poor at is sleep.
Yeah.
And are there apps or are there devices that can really have an impact on sleep hygiene, sleep behaviors?
Right. So most of the devices at the moment are designed to measure your sleep. The status of the technology at the moment is still not that great for in changing your sleep habits. We've got some basic sleep, we know that the sleep hygiene facts of a cool room and dark and so on, but you don't need a device to be able to tell you that. But a device can tell you the quality of the quantity and the quality of your sleep. And the devices at the moment, they actually combine physical activity tracking with sleep tracking. There's been a trend in the consumer devices recently to move from a device that you wore around your waist to measure activity to now a device you wear on your wrist to measure sleep and activity. So you lose some accuracy from activity because it's on your wrist, but you gain a whole new insight into a third of your life that you spend sleeping. And so the studies show that they're quite good at measuring how long you sleep, sleep duration. There are a few caveats to that because they're not very good at the few minutes before you go fall asleep because you're fidgeting and so on. It thinks you might be awake or asleep. Yeah. But they're quite good at measuring sleep duration. And the other thing they're quite good at, because your wrists give away a lot about how you sleep, the restlessness of your sleep or the wakefulness of your sleep. And so the devices use scientifically proven algorithms to crunch the data and show how disrupted your sleep was. And you get these really simple reports at the end of each night that you how much time you spent awake, even though you're not sort of visibly awake, but you were restless. And so you can start to then use your sleep hygiene habits by change the temperature of your room, the darkness of your room, and you can see how your sleep changes. So regardless of whether the device is very accurate in measuring sleep quantity and quality, we know that they're pretty reliable. So in other words, if I get some data on me and I keep using the device, even if it's not getting how much sleep I'm getting or if I'm missing it by 20 minutes, it's always going to do that for me. And so I can see change over time. So it's a really useful device. And many people have used it successfully to improve the quality of their sleep. So it's a really nice added feature.
And that's so important for general health.
It's important, and we're learning more now about the role of sleep in health. Before, we thought it was just related to stress and other things and wakefulness during the day, but now we know it's related to metabolism, we know it's related to dietary choices during the day, it's related to a whole host of things. So sleep is the sort of a really new behavior to start measuring and helpful.
Right, and even inflammation.
Exactly.
And obesity, yep. And all of those issues.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, Simon, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been very enlightening, and I think I'm going to have to go and load some apps onto my phone.
Good, and buy a wireless device.
Yes, I think I might have to. What's the best wireless device?
Well, I would never claim to have allegiance to any one particular one. Objective science. But what I will say, there are some good devices out there. Things like the Fitbit is a great device. Between about $50, you can buy a simple device. A simple pedometer for $25 is also good. If you can get one made in Japan, it's even better.
Okay, so, well, I'll head out there
device.
And get one. Thank you.
No problem. My pleasure.
So there it is, an unbiased academic opinion on what's worth taking a look at in today's mobile health technology. You know technology is here to stay, and as I see it, we have three choices. We can try to ignore it. We can become its slave as couch potatoes or screen addicts. Or we can become the master over a powerful tool for self-monitoring and setting and achieving goals, helping us to stay on track. In a future show, we'll explore the world of video games for health. But that's all from me for now. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.